protection for the railroads. I mean, it's well documented that, you know, there's a lot of controversy on what that locomotive looked like, and I've listened to some of the historians, and I agree, we don't know what it looks like. There was a mistake based on a much later sketch that his son found in his notes, but it's clearly of another locomotive that Trevithick had built for yet another railway. So we really don't quite know what the first one looked like. Unlike the Wright brothers, who actually had somebody standing by with a camera, the little problem was there wasn't a really proper camera in 1804 to take pictures. And there were some sketches and paintings and things and news articles, but not enough to actually know what the thing looked like, which, yeah. But my elemental point of bringing up the Wright brothers was, if you look onwards 100 years, airplanes had developed a great deal, even in a very short matter of, to 1913, where the planes were still somewhat flimsy and small, but they were starting to really show their signs. And then with the impetus of the war, by the 1920s, there were actual, the British had a four-engine airliner, and you could fly from England to, way outside of London. I forget the airport, but it's way outside. And you could fly to Paris. So this happened just, you know, within 20 years of creating a plane, you could, you know, get on and fly one. And you pay passenger. Well, we happen to know that there's a lot of point that during the Pendennis experiment with the locomotive pulling the hopper cars, a lot of people jumped on board. In some ways, they could be purported to be the world's first steam hobos. Not really, but that's, we could look at it that way. Well, okay, again, we're looking at these dates. We're going back, not to the 20th century, but to the 19th century. And as I keep going on and on about the early days of steam engines, and this was focused a great deal on the British Isles, I will have to go into more detail at another time, but there were a lot of reasons for this, and some of them were, I never thought about it before, but they were very geopolitical. Not just the science, but there were a lot of reasons to do this, and unbelievably, including war. One of the things, when Trevithick built his first steam engine, there were wars going on, and there was a heavy demand for horses to work in the army, and people were getting not as good a horse flesh for their mine and other tram roads. And they said, oh, gosh, could we get around that somehow? And when Trevithick presented them with the true, actually working steam locomotive that could pull things, woohoo! Inventors galore came out of the woods, and engineers of all sizes and calibers went to work on the problem. And from 1804 to 1814 to 1824, there were a whole skadzooks of different inventors building the first locomotives. Well, yes, by the mid and late 1825 and 26, there were full-blown railways being built, steel rail flanged wheels, whether it's the Stockton and Darlington or the equally famous ones like the Liverpool and Manchester Railway, which was very fancy for its day, considering how early it was. Two tracks, one going each way, and they had signalments, you know, towers or places at intervals to signal the trains. And interestingly enough, that particular railroad has a uniquity, I say very unique, that's not unique today. I said, whoa, 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 whoa. Okay. If you had a tram road somewhere and it was up 4 or 5 kilometers of track, and a lot of that was going off on little places, and you had horses pulling these wagons, and they were carrying slate, or they're carrying coal, or they're carrying iron ore. They weren't going very far, and for all practical purposes, they were running on your own property. Well, maybe not the person running it, but the owners. You know, it might have been one person, it might have been 4 or 5, who jointly owned the mine and controlled the mine. It was all theirs. I mean, it was like building a I hate to want to put it that way, but building a garden railway in your own yard. You can run whatever you want there. But with the development of the steam engine, the idea was, with one of these first major twin track things, was that anybody could bring their locomotive, put it on it. We had to test it and say, yeah, it's an safe locomotive, blah, blah, blah. But they could then run it. That really didn't happen all that much, and it went back to the point of where you really only wanted your locomotives on your railway because either they were the correct gauge, whether it was a track gauge or, for that matter, that the smokestack wasn't too high to hit bridges or tunnels. It wasn't too wide that could go through the tunnels. It had, you know, there were a lot of considerations there, so there was not so much interchangement. But again, as I say, this boom in 1820s was not too different from the aviation boom 100 years later, the technological advancement. Now, I came across some just basic numbers. I'm not going to give you hard and fast numbers. I don't do that. But from 1828 to 1856, the Stevenson and Company, or I should say, there were at least, or on the order of, 50 locomotives imported into North America from the United Kingdom. I'm not kidding, 50. Now, well, 49 to 50, there's a question, because some were technically lost, some didn't work, and I'll go into stories about that sometime, I hope, because some of those are funny. But the United States of that time period really quit importing locomotives by the late 1830s, okay? 1837 or so. Now, Canada being part of the Dominion of the United Kingdom, of course, they're going to keep importing. But, by that point, the U.S. was, the United States was now manufacturing its own locomotives. And matter of fact, by the 1850s, the United States was exporting locomotives. But as we had imported so many British locomotives, they all, or most all, were the same gauge, the 1435 millimeter gauge, that Stevenson, George Stevenson, later, he wasn't the first, but later sort of bumbled, you know, blah, blah, blah. He didn't plan it exactly, it just sort of happened. And since we had bought those, we built new locomotives to run on them, they were that gauge, and we exported them. So that was one of the things. I've talked about that before, and I'll come back to it. But these, I mean, I'll give you a nice date, because you're supposed to give dates in documentaries. On the 8th of August, 1829, remember, look at that, 29. The first locomotive from the British Isles came in, which was the Stourbridge Lion. Well, it's a fairly famous locomotive. It's in lots of write-ups. But it was not a highly successful locomotive for a couple of little reasons. In the United Kingdom, they had gotten in their heads. Now, this is not incorrect. This is not incorrect. But they got it in their heads really early on that for a train to run on tracks, the tracks had to be really straight or really well-built and really tightly manufactured. So long before it was actually necessary, the British were already, and this was across all the aisles, were putting in iron rails. They were mounting them into stone blocks, doing a lot of things. I mean, in a sense that we now talk about for high, fancy railroads, for really high capacity railroads. But they were doing it back in the 1820s, you know. Partially because of the quality of the locomotive. See, if you made really good track, the locomotive worked better. Well, this is a flash for people. I'm going to go off my little topic here. In the United States, at that time, steel was not really available, and iron was expensive. So, to build tracks, what the United States had, especially in the East at the time, where most people were, they had lots of forest. They had lots of trees, and they cut down trees, and they made the railroad tracks out of wood. No, I am not joking you. I am not joking you. The rails were made out of wood. And what they tended to do was put a little strip, a little thin strip of iron on top of the wood or on the edge of the wood. You might say this very large, crunky thing of wood was on this side, one over this side. And then you put a little strip of iron, and then the rails, the wheels would sit on those little iron parts. Not so much for strength, because this was literally strapping. It was just, I mean, if you pulled it up and you were fairly strong, you could probably bend it, you know. At least two men could probably bend that iron strips. That, but it was there for wear. It was so that the iron wheels wouldn't wear down the wood. Well, the poor Strawbridge Lion was put on this wooden track, and it may not have had the iron on it, and had a tendency to fall off. Now, I have in the past used the phrase rustic American track as opposed to lousy. But the truth was, it was pretty lousy. But it wasn't that long before people got it through their heads to lay much more really significant iron. Well, okay. So, what happened? We had steam engines, and I will talk about the expansion of steam across the eastern and then the western United States. The British had rail lines going all over the place. I'm going to come back and someday talk about something known as the mania, and that's when they went absolutely railroad crazy and built lines everywhere. But railroad building was quite a thing. And I'm going to come back. I will come back. It's another topic for another day, which will be European railway lines. We tend to talk a lot about the British and the United States. And I'll give you a real clue. That's because from Trevithick's 1804 locomotive and operation, right through to, the 1830s, and even a little later in places, 1840, there was no heavy building of railways anywhere else. I will come back to this in more detail, but this is a flash for people. By that early period of railroad building, the only European country to fully embrace steam engines heavily was Belgium, which had just recently separated from the Dutch, the Netherlands, and they'd become a separate entity. And they were keen on engineering and new tech. And so they were the big builders of all things. And matter of fact, for the most part, it was government building. So that's worth a whole show. We'll come back and talk about that. But I wanted to go over this because I talked to some folks on the phone a while back, and they were curious about, you know, steam engines and what did they do. And the steam engine was the main way. By the way, come back to 1903, when the Wright brothers had designed several gliders and other pieces of equipment in preceding years and in 1903 as well. I want to make that clear. In all those times, they had taken their gliders and now their powered aircraft to the dunes in North Carolina because they thought that would be a good place to test them. Anyway, I want to make it clear. Those were boxed up, broken down into parts, put into crates, and taken there by trains. All of that, the Wright brothers would go from Dayton, Ohio, to North Carolina by train, and they would ship all the parts and everything they had by rail. So that first airplane made its first trip from the factory in Dayton to North Carolina in a train. Well, just to roll forward a little quick here, the steam engine was the most important way of moving anything through the first half of the 20th century. Oh, yes, we had some trucks, and even in World War II, you see trucks going here and there, but it was trains that moved the, outside of going across oceans, if you're trying to go across land, you had to have trains. In the First World War, one of the first things the U.S. actually sent to France were locomotives. They needed more locomotives than they could build to move the supplies. It's trains that move things. Well, for the most part, I'm going to talk about North America here, and I'll come back to Britain. I want to do more research on that because it's a funny story in its own right. But within the United States, at least, mainline steam service ended generally at the end of the 1950s. But 1955 to 1965, by 1960s, 61, 62, there were very few steam engines in mainline service. That means, you know, going across country or major thing. They were still all over the place as switch engines. They were all over the place. And matter of fact, it turns out I was doing a quick research. I'm not going to give you all the details because they're sort of dull. But I found that some small steam engines, very small ones, as again, these were mostly used for switching or local service in a factory or some sort of complex, were in service into the 1980s. Not kidding, into the 1980s. And there's some information that the locomotives, which I talked about my last time, which were fireless steam engines, where it used a fixed boiler place to get the steam from, were in service perhaps, I can't confirm this, but perhaps as late as 2001. Now, I know for a fact that some compressed air, atmospheric pneumatic locomotives were still in service at that time. So I'll come back and talk about those again at another time. Well, the thing was, as steam was the most prevalent source, and I'm going to go into the successor to steam that didn't happen but is happening, okay? Ooh, that sounds like a teaser. All right, what we have across North America, not in Europe, I'm only going to talk about America, is the diesel locomotive. Now, the first diesel engine was designed and built in 1892 by Rudolf Diesel, a European, I believe a German. It might have been a Prussian, but I'm not sure. But anyway, or an Austrian. But anyway, it's a European. That's all there is to it. It was in Europe. And at first, nobody could see a use for the diesel system because they were quite cantankerous. But it wasn't all that long. It was not all that long till, and I'm going to get you this one, ALCO, A-L-C-O. That's one of those railroad terms you might want to hear about. That's the letters stand for the American Locomotive Company. That's what was ALCO. And they built a very useful, handy switch engine in 1925 that sold very well. Well, It wasn't till it was as early as 1929 that the Canadian National Railway put two large diesel locomotives into mainline service. That's in 1929. So again, we're when something comes into service to when it's still a prop, you know, some things have a long lifespan. Now, let's just stop for a half second. Why was the diesel jumped on so quickly? Okay. Not that steam didn't work. Steam worked great. But steam had two flaws, okay? The diesel was slightly more, and I'm going to say slightly, but it's more efficient. In other words, the amount of cost of fuel to amount of work done, it's better. It's not overwhelmingly better, but it's definitely better. But what was more important, much more important to railroads, remember I've told you they're a tight-fisted lot, it required less personnel. With a steam engine, you had to have a boiler operator on board. You had to have the two people. Now, they kept the two people in a diesel. They started turning them into a co-driver for a while, and still is on some services, which is a good idea to keep you awake. But the main point was, when you got the steam engine back to the shop, to the station or depot or wherever it was, a whole bunch of other workers besides those two had to send on that locomotive every night. I said every night. They had to dump the fire, let the fire go out. They had to dump all the gunk out of it, clean out the ashes, clean out all the clinkers and stuff, and do a lot of servicing. Well, a well-managed diesel needed to have the oil checked, needed to have it filled with diesel. It might have need to have, in 1925, the bearings, which I'll get to that one too, had to be checked. But all of that could be done by one person in, oh my gosh, 10, 15 minutes? I mean, all of it, you know, maybe even putting sand in and maybe washing the windows even. You might get all that done in 15 or 20 minutes. You could never do that on a steam engine. The amount of labor and work was quite significant. So what doomed the steam engine was truly the amount of personnel and work effort to make the locomotives go. So that's what brought in the diesel. Now, as a teaser, if somebody will listen to me again in the future, I don't say when, but some hopefully in the future, I will come back and talk about the electric locomotive. And the electric locomotive, by the end of the 19th century, that's 1895, 1880s even, their real belief was that steam would be replaced by electric. Electric was the way to go. Now, that didn't quite happen, but as I have said in other things, the bulk of the European railway network is electrified with overhead wire. And I've been on an electric locomotive that has crossed three different countries in one trip. I am not making that up. Three different countries. I've been on a train that has pulled out of a station in Germany, crossed through Austria, and gone on to, oh, I don't say Hungary. And while they might change locomotives, but it's always under the wire. And in some cases, I was on one train that went all the way through. They just stopped and changed drivers. You know, say, hi, Fred, hi, Hans, hey, you know, Rudolph. And they got in, and off they went. So we'll come back. I'll come back and do a whole thing on electrics. But the diesel, and I think we should do a whole show on diesels because there's a lot of squirreliness to how diesels work and how because there are many ways a diesel can work. And I guess it'd probably be a good idea if I came out sometime and mentioned all the other ways to make locomotives go. I think the one system that nobody ever tried was winding up a rubber band. Although there is the Perry People Mover, which is a little tiny rail car, and it does not hold that many people, I think about 20 people, and it's on a really short kilometer or so or less run on almost level ground, and it uses a flywheel. It stops, a little shoe, it engages the little electric pickup, it spins up the flywheel, and you take off and use the energy of the flywheel to go to the next station. That is a borderline case. So there's always a borderline case on things. Funny, they could have done that with a fireless steam engine. Remember, a fireless steam engine has one advantage. You don't have to drop the fire. All you have to do at the end of the day is open a valve and let all the water that's built up inside drain out. Maybe hook it up to an airline and go and wash it. And it's ready to go the next day because there's no fire. All right. Well, that's all for right now. And I've talked a little about how steam and diesel and some of the other powers. And we'll hopefully be able to come up with a whole show on some of these items. Thank you very much, Shan. As always, I hope to see you on the train. Bye-bye.